time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeBlantis. This week in 97, we didn't know it was an historic Cubs game, but it turned out to be. Anna?
Yeah, bittersweet memory, Bob, for most of us Cubs fans. This week, 1997, Harry Carey called his final game for the Cubs. It was September 21st, 1997, after more than half a century behind the mic, 52 years calling games, 16 for the Cubs, 11 for the Sox, 25 for the Cardinals. Here's how Harry Carey signed off in his final game in the booth at Wrigley Field. This was at the conclusion of the 1997 season, Bob.
Andy, you remember that one, right?
I certainly do. And I think that was Ryan Sandberg's last home game as a Cub.
Mm. And Jim Riggleman was the manager.
He was the manager, and he kind of led the players to kind of go around the stadium and shake hands with some fans and at least acknowledge the patrons there that day.
1997.
Yeah. You got to love his enthusiasm.
What's that, Anna?
You just got to love his enthusiasm for the game. I mean, you just hear it there, that he'd been doing it for 50 years, and his love was just so palpable at that moment. Interesting.
That was always the thing that impressed me about Harry, is he always sounded like somebody seeing his first baseball game.
right. I'm like, wait a minute, you've been doing this for half a century, guy. But that's
very,
why you loved him.
Very historic date, 1960 in Chicago this week, and this was history, wasn't it?
It absolutely was, Bob. This week, 1960, Chicago made television history, broadcasting the Kennedy-Nixon debates, the first presidential debate ever to be televised. 70 million people tuned in back then in 1960. Think about that. Two-thirds of the adult population in the United States to watch Senator John F. Kennedy face off with Vice President Richard Nixon at the old Chicago Arena. It was then WBBM Studios on McClure Court. And books have been written, Bob, as you know, about that day, how it transformed politics forever. The whole focus on image, looks, body language, the visual connection to the voter, and this concise messaging and hand gesturing, all of that became a critical part of running for office, all due to Nixon's performance, his poor performance, I might add, that day in Chicago. At least that's how it was perceived by the TV audience. Nixon wore this gray suit against a gray background. His 5 o'clock shadow, accentuated on the black and white televisions at the time, gave him this sinister look. His skin was pale. He refused to wear professional makeup, that time only. His face, they said, looked sickly. He actually was sick at the time, recovering from a staph infection. And he, without powder, he was sweating under the TV lights. He looked uncomfortable. Mayor Daley, not a supporter, gave an interview at the time in Chicago Press to say Nixon looked like he had been embalmed before he died. And I think that's kind of how a lot of people perceived it. Chicago Daily News ran a story a few days later saying, was Nixon sabotaged by a TV makeup artist? It was the talk of town, and it didn't help that Kennedy, by contrast, was tan. He was powdered. He was coiffed. He looked like a million bucks in his dark blue suit that popped against the background. And he rehearsed. He rehearsed in front of cameras and looking into the camera, and it mattered. It showed. In the end, famously, the TV audience was polled and overwhelmingly thought Kennedy had won the debates. The radio audience, by contrast, thought Nixon had won the debates, said he had many more compelling points. He knew more about foreign affairs and stronger arguments. Without that visual element, it was interesting to see the difference. We pulled a clip from each candidate looking back at 1960. See if you have an opinion as you listen in.
Sounds so civil, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Producer Joe and I were talking about those clips, that the way they kind of handled these debates, they weren't trying to necessarily land insults. It was very much about the issues, you know, kind of interesting.
And that was one of four they had that year, wasn't it?
Yeah, four presidential debates. Nixon actually did much better, Bob, in the later ones, as you know, but viewership was just so much lower because they weren't making history with the other three, just the first one. So the perception was still, in the end, that Kennedy had won the debates. Kind of interesting.
Oprah made some TV history with a feature she launched this week in 1996, and it was a big one. It worked.
It worked on so many levels. Oprah launched her book club, which launched so many other authors' careers. I mean, it just went on to be like every publisher wanted to have their author on Oprah's book club. But she started out just saying, you know, growing up, books were my friends, and I want to share the great books I know and new ones that I'll discover with my audience. Jacqueline Mitchard was the first author selected. She published her debut novel, just a few months earlier. It was called The Deep End of the Ocean, and it was a story set in Chicago about the disappearance of a child. Oprah endorsed the book in September, and by the end of the year, it had sold millions of copies and was a New York Times bestseller. She did that again and again for dozens of authors, but the one thing that I think many of us will recall that stood out from the book club, Bob, and you'll recall this too, James Frey, who wrote A Million Little Pieces, appeared on Oprah's book club and reportedly embellished these large sections of his book. Even though it was a memoir, there were a number of events he talked about that just didn't happen, and the investigative news outlet Smoking Gun went point by point, tearing apart some of the issues. Oprah was not happy because he had come on her show to talk about those things, and she thought that he had deceived her. So she brought James Frey back on the show for a mea culpa, and we pulled a clip of that.
I forgot all about that controversy.
It was a big one. And interestingly, Bob, the publisher stood by him, the author, and saying that memoirs can't be fact-checked the way other books can. But they did end up putting a disclaimer on the book, saying a nonfiction book. Some facts may not be, you know, what you think. So
a lot of running in Chicago this week in 1977. Anna?
Yeah, always love the marathon, big event here in Chicago. And 2 years after that song came out, Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, the Chicago area held its first marathon, the very first one, Bob, September 25th, 1977. That's when it was run. It was called the Mayor Daily Marathon back then. 4,000 participants came out that first year. Over the decades, it grew into one of the world's six top marathons, of course. But where do you think they started it that first year, the Mayor Daily Marathon? Where did it kick off, Bob? Any guesses?
Well, probably at the Daily Plaza.
Daily Plaza is where it started. It had the big Picasso, and it was named Daily, and the marathon was named Daily, and Daily was darn proud of this marathon. So that's where you started the Daily Marathon. And it's interesting. Daily said he didn't want to look like, you know, he was second place to New York, so it was going to be bigger and better and all that stuff. And funny, just to go back and look at the videos from that day, Bob, because you see, like, it was before the day of the high-performance running shoes and the athletic gear, and people were wearing, like, Adidas shoes and khaki shorts and high knee socks and just running the marathon. And gosh darn it, they did it. So, you know.
What do you know? You didn't need a professional outfit. How about that?
No.
ER came to Chicago, and I forgot all about this, but George Clooney was here for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah. I don't remember ever having a sighting personally or anything of the cast, but they were here every year just about this week, starting in 1993. That's when they shot the first exterior scenes. The majority of the show, the indoor part, was in Burbank. That's the official ER set. But end of summer, before every season, the ER cast would come on out to Chicago to shoot shots, scenes across the city. This week, 1993, George Clooney was spotted walking along the Chicago River. Noah Wiley was spotted under the L. Lots of shooting was happening outside Cook County Hospital on Harrison. That was the setting, the official setting for the fictional County General Hospital, featured in ER. The show that catapulted Anthony Edwards, George Clooney, Juliana Margulies, so many others, and become household names. And from that season on, they came back every year around this time. Just that George Clooney needed a little more security on his subsequent visits to Jimmy.
He got a little more popular. And finally, we have some candy history to report.
Yeah, do you like Red Hots, Bob? I know you don't like the chewy things that get stuck in your teeth, but do you like Red Hots?
I've never been a big fan of those.
Well, they've survived 93 years, so they got something going for them.
Yep.
Italian immigrant turned Chicago entrepreneur Salvatore Ferrara started Red Hots 93 years ago, and he might say that he was taking a chance back then because the majority of hard candies were sweet, they were fruity, they were minty, and these kind of felt like heat in your mouth, like really hot cinnamon. But just became a classic and a classic movie theater concession too. So they just took off, and it's hard to imagine the holidays, I think, without Red Hots, because Valentine's Day, they're huge. You see them at Christmas and Halloween. Cake decorators, people who decorate cupcakes, love the Red Hots, the way they look. So surviving and going 93 years strong. So they're pretty pretty tasty to this day, Bob.
Red Hots and tamales, too, right?
Yes. Love those, too.
Anna DeVlantis, talk to you again next Wednesday. Thank you.
Talk to you then.